Welcome to the Nerd Party.
Hello and welcome to the A24 Project, where we look at two films from the A24 filmography every 2 weeks. This week we're looking at two of their most acclaimed movies, American Honey and the Oscar-winning Moonlight. And joining me as ever is Dallas King. How are you, Dallas?
I'm very well. How's yourself?
Yeah, not too bad. It's a bit of a heat wave at the moment, so it seems fitting that we should be discussing these two movies today in this kind of weather.
Absolutely.
And I'm excited to say we're joined by Megan Wilson, podcaster, writer for one of my favourite sites and podcasts out there, Screen Queens. Welcome to the show, Megan.
Hi, thank you. I'm really excited to be here.
Yeah, anytime we get a guest on the show, Meg, we love to learn a little bit about their relationship and opinions on A24. And for a while, whenever you typed A24 into sort of the podcast app on iTunes, our show and your show would pop up on the same kind of little search bar because you guys have done sort of an A24 top tier episode one day. So you must be a bit of a fan of them. So what's your kind of view of them as a distribution company?
Yeah, so we did an episode a while ago for the anniversary, and we did... I think we just picked our top threes or top fives. I can't remember. We kind of did a bit of a retrospective over kind of what our favourite films were, and like kind of the amount that we've seen. I feel like I thought I'd seen a reasonable amount, and then I realised that like I hadn't. But yeah, I definitely would say I am kind of a fan of their work. I guess like you definitely see like a lot of sort of similarities between the types of things that they tend to kind of produce and distribute, and as a fan of like indie cinema, and they have made some of or distributed some of my favorite films like of all time, like Moonlight, which I'm very excited to be talking about. So yeah, I definitely do seek out, you know, like if I see a film is being produced or like distributed by them, like having that kind of label on it will draw me to it. I feel like that's probably the case for a lot of us. Like we're kind of drawn to that like A24 brand because they do have a good history, especially in recent years, kind of being attached to really great projects that tend to do really well on like the festival circuits and kind of always seem to hit it off with film Twitter and stuff. So yeah, that's kind of my overall opinion of them, and yeah, I'm a big fan of American Honey and Moonlight, so really excited to be talking about them.
What other kind of A24 films are you kind of drawn to personally? What ones have kind of stood out for you in the past few years, and which ones, as you say, that there's some that you still got to seek out, which ones are kind of on your watch list at the moment?
I think amongst my other favourites, recently, The Farewell. Did they just distribute The Farewell in the US? But yeah, The Farewell I saw at Sundance London this year, and adored it. It really, really moved me that... I've had a bit of an experience watching it. It was kind of one of those ones where, you know, you just become so attached to like a group of people, and as a kind of family story, like it really, yeah, I came out of it that really crying quite a lot. Recently also, Eighth Grade, I enjoyed a lot. Again, kind of really took me back to a really specific time in my life that kind of put me through the ringer. That like was a really, I feel like, yeah, with a lot of their films, I feel like they're often not the easiest experiences, in the sense that I find that very often they're narratives that like I really relate to, so sometimes revisiting those times in my life or like those specific situations aren't always like necessarily joyful experiences. They can be quite like testing or like sad, but I think they're always very worthy experiences. I love Lady Bird, obviously. That was a funny one. I saw that like with my mum like the night before she left me all alone in America to study for a semester, so I just bawled my eyes out. It was like sort of one of those real perfect like situations where you watch a film at the right time with the right person, and it kind of, even though I don't have nearly as tempestuous a relationship with my mum as Lady Bird does, but it still kind of, you know, really hit a nerve in some respects. I'm just trying to think. I'm going through a list now just to remind myself. But like, yeah, a ghost story. I love a ghost story. Killing of a Sacred Deer. I kind of like the more like those kind of edgier, like scary one. I mean, I'm not one for horror whatsoever. I hate them. So I've not seen like Hereditary or things like that. Not planning on seeing Midsommar. But in terms of like films that I wouldn't necessarily call like horror, but have kind of thrilling or like scary or like existential elements, like A Ghost Story or Killing of a Sacred Deer, I really enjoy.
Will you be treating yourself to the, I think they've advertised on the A24 Twitter feed today that they're going to be selling a dog or a sort of a puppy version of the creature from The Farewell. Will you be looking to buy that when it comes out?
I mean, will I be able to resist? We'll see.
No doubt it'll be like $80 or something like that in the A24 shop.
Yeah, I couldn't want it, but then I go online and I'm like, we see the price tag and we're not so sure.
So kind of coming to sort of our A24 hour news segment, Uncut Gems finally has a release date for December 13th, and that's going to be the Safdie Brothers follow-up to Good Times, and it'll be starring Adam Sandler. So it's set in the Diamond District of New York City, and a jewelry store owner and dealer to the rich and famous must find a way to pay his debts when his merchandise is taken from one of his top sellers and his girlfriend. So it's interesting to see this film slotted in amongst the big hitters of sort of 2019 for that kind of period of time, and I think Cats comes out then as well. So are you guys excited for an Adam Sandler A24 movie coming out this Christmas? Dallas, are you looking forward to this one?
I am, yes, actually, yeah. I've been looking through the cast list, and the cast list is fantastic. I'm going to be interested to see what they do with Idina Menzel, because, you know, she was a huge star in the original production of Wicked, and they used her in Enchanted, but in the theatrical version she never sang, which was basically a waste of her talent. So I'm going to be interested to see if she sings in this one, but I'm looking forward to seeing what Adam Sandler can do, because given the right role, yeah, he can be a very good dramatic actor, sort of Punch Drunk Love. I thought he was very good in the Meyerowitz stories as well. But since then, he sort of seemed to have dipped back into his old ways on Netflix and stuff like that. So it's going to be interesting to see what the Safdie brothers do. I mean, they got a fantastic performance out of Robert Pattinson in Good Time, which is, I think, one of our favourite sort of A24 films at the moment. So, yeah, very looking forward to this one, I think.
What about for you, Meg? I'm kind of got my fingers crossed this is going to come out at kind of London Film Festival based on sort of the time of the year. Is this one that you're looking forward to, or is this sort of one that's going to be kind of maybe pass you by?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, I didn't know a whole lot about it. I didn't even know Adam Sandler was in it. But, yeah, it does seem like a really interesting combination of plot, actor, release date. But having seen Good Time and having really enjoyed Good Time, I trust that the Safdies will make another good film. So I think it might be a tough one to follow. I really enjoyed Good Time. It was very intense. It was, again, one of those experiences that I can't say I necessarily like enjoyed watching it. I think I was very stressed for most of it. But yeah, I really liked it. So yeah, I'm excited to see what they do next.
And IndieWire got incredibly impatient this week and released their Best of the Decade Top 100. So hopefully their fall film festival passes will be revoked, because obviously they're just wasting their time going along. But as a distributor less than a decade old, A24 make up nearly one-tenth of the picks, with The Souvenir, A Ghost Story, Hereditary, Spring Breakers, High Life, First Reformed, Lady Bird, Under the Skin, and Moonlight coming in at number one. So what did you guys make of those choices of film?
But Moonlight top, like, come on, like, absolutely, what a good choice. Like, I would put it at my, I mean, anybody who knows anything about me knows that my favourite film of all time is Carol, but Moonlight is a very, 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 very close second. So I am by no means disappointed that it is at number one. I think that is a great choice. Because, yeah, I just think it is one of the most kind of essential films that has been released. Like, I would say of all time, not even the decade. Like, why not just go ever?
You're making, like, the perfect advert for why we got you onto this episode of all time. So, like, we're definitely sorted there. What about for yourself, Dallas? What did you make of this top 100 of the decade, a.k.a. incredibly early? See, this is missing the opportunity to add Cats in as well. Who knows? This could have been on the list too. What did you make of it?
I thought the list was very good. In terms of A24 films, I was scrolling through and going, oh, that's an A24, that's an A24. It was getting up towards the top and I was like, they don't have Under the Skin in here. And then it peaked in at number 2. I think Carol was definitely in the top 10. I think it was maybe around about 6 or something. And Moonlight, you know, it's hard to argue, I think, in terms of impact and stuff like that for the decade. I didn't have a problem with the A24 films that they'd selected. I did have a big problem with the fact that they didn't have any films by Denis Villeneuve, who's basically my favourite director of the last decade, up there with Nolan. Blade Runner 2049 I would have had in, Arrival I would have had in, basically all of his films I probably would have put into the top 10. I think I did a massive long list on replying to your Nerd Party tweet yesterday that had about 16 films of me personally I would have had in, sort of Gravity and stuff like that, but overall, it was a very good list. I think I'd seen about 70 of the 100, so I do have some homework to do, and I've got another 30 films to watch. So I'm interested to see those ones to find out why they're rated so highly.
Did you see the list yourself, Meg? Was there anything that you were like, oh, I wish that had been added on as well?
Yeah, interestingly, I have. So yes, Moonlight, obviously, I've not actually seen Under the Skin, so that's one that's definitely on my list of things to watch and has been for a really long time. I don't know why it's sort of one that I've never really gotten around to, but yeah, I'm just looking at it now and I'm really interested to see The Act of Killing is number 4, which is a documentary that I watched on my first year of my film degree and like really enjoyed, but like I would never have kind of, I don't know, I'm surprised to see it there, but also it's great. Like, I don't know, it just seems a bit out of nowhere. Again, I've not seen a lot of these things, which is either really embarrassing on my part. But yeah, the fact of Carol coming in at number 7 is pleasing, to say the least. The Master, yeah, excellent, love that. Yeah, I think there's a lot of good stuff on here. I'd say that there are some good choices, some surprises, but overall, yeah.
So kind of last week on the show, we had an interview with Jared Moshe, the writer-director of The Ballad of Lefty Brown. And we can now reveal another 2 interviews that sort of have been recorded. I don't want to jinx another 2 that I'm planning to do this week. But coming up in the next month, we're going to have interviews with Patricia Rosamond, one of the most prominent directors from Canada. She'll be coming to talk with us about Into the Forest. And next week, you can join us for an interview with Azazel Jacobs, the writer-director of The Lovers. So here's a small preview of that upcoming interview. Once the film's completed and it's ready to be sent out into the world, like, obviously A24 has this reputation for its marketing and release strategy. What was it like for The Lovers? How did you get much involvement in sort of how it's marketed and released, or is it very much in their hands after?
So much involvement. I'm so thankful. They let me be as involved as I wanted to be, which I cannot tell you was such a blessing. I mean, it was so painful. I mean, I really was not happy the way that Terry was marketed. I was very much just like, you know, you just kind of, I felt in different ways. Well, you're the filmmaker. You do your thing. We do our thing and just stay out of this, which is just doesn't make any sense because, well, I know they've been working in a different way than I've been working on things. Like, it just not to be heard is so frustrated. But with A24's case, I felt really the opposite. I felt completely part of the conversation and even if we differed on some things, I always felt very like respected and very heard. We talked very early on that since this already has a distribution, a plan and company and a great company behind it, let's not go the festival way with this. Let's not apply to Sundance. Let's go straight to theaters with this and not do the kind of year or potential year of promotions, which was something that I brought up to them and they were keen. They were up to that idea. They liked that idea. I didn't know what I've had Sundance has been a wonderful festival to me and a bunch of festivals have been great to me, but in this case I didn't know what it was going to bring, how it was going to help, because usually I would show it at Sundance to try to attract an A24, to try to build the kind of hype that A24 was already great at doing on their own.
So you can find The Lovers on UK Netflix now if you want to watch the film ahead of the interview. So hopefully you'll enjoy join us for next week, because it's really interesting to hear what he had to say about working with A24, because The Lovers was actually the second ever movie that they produced from the start, much like Moonlight, actually followed Moonlight, that they invested in from the start. So it was really interesting to sort of hear about that film's journey. So hopefully you'll all join us next week for that one. But we'll move on to sort of our two movies for the day. And our first one is American Honey, written and directed by Andrea Arnold, and stars. And the film stars Sasha Lane, Shia LaBeouf, and Riley Keough. And the film follows Star, a teenage girl from a troubled home who runs away with a traveling sales crew who drive across the American Midwest selling magazine subscriptions door to door. So Meg, when did you first see American Honey, and what were your expectations going in, and what was your initial reaction to this film?
Well, it took me quite a while to see American Honey, actually. I remember when it first came out, and I remember it catching my attention because I tried to go and see it. I just started uni, actually, not long ago, and me and my flatmate went to try and see it at the BFI, but we didn't have the foresight to buy tickets in advance. Like, we didn't think it was, I don't know, like, I didn't think it'd be sold out, but it was, so we couldn't see it, which was really sad. I ended up not having the time to go back and see it, and then missed it in the cinema completely. And then it was one of those things where I just always said that I would see it and didn't. And I think also, like, me and my minute attention span will always put off watching films that I know are over 2 hours long, in the sense that I feel like I need to, you know, sit down and give it my full attention, and it's going to be like an experience, we'll say. So yeah, then it just passed me by for what, like 2 years. So I watched it last year, and I think it was actually an interesting time for me to then watch it, because it was when I was studying in the US last year, and I was staying with my friend who Andrea Arnold is like her favorite director ever. She loves, I think American Honey is her favorite film, and she kept telling me to watch it, and we were just at home one night, and she was like, okay, now is the time that you need to watch American Honey. So I wasn't going to argue. So we put it on, and admittedly, I watched it in two halves, I have to say, because we started it, and then I think about an hour and a half in, we were just knackered, because I was staying with her, and I don't know, we'd been doing a lot of stuff. So I was extremely tired, and I was like, I was dropping off, I have to say. So we watched the second half the following night. But yeah, I really enjoyed it. I think, again, it was sort of one of those experiences where the whole way through, yeah, maybe enjoy is the wrong word. But actually, no, I would say not, because there are moments that do feel very, like, joyful and are very, like, exhilarating, and you feel like you want to be there and you want to be living it. But then there's also so much that you're so aware is really challenging and difficult to watch and to watch those characters go through those situations and be in those situations. And I think it was, like I said, it was kind of an interesting time in my life to watch it for the first time, having spent a significant amount of time in the US and thinking about what life in the US is like for a lot of people, and this idea of, like, the American dream, and, like, how do we see the US, and, like, I'd become aware, I think, of how big it is, which sounds kind of silly, but the idea that there is so much kind of vast, empty space, like, so little of the actual US is kind of inhabited, if that makes sense. Like, you can just drive for hours and hours and hours and not kind of come across another person or another place, and that is quite scary to me. I don't know, like, the UK seems very, very tiny by comparison, and the fact that, like, I don't know, you can cross it in a matter of hours, whereas, like, US, so I feel like kind of the road movie and, like, the road kind of epic movie feels very unique in some ways to America and kind of middle America and, like, these very detached, isolated locations that aren't just, like, the West Coast or the East Coast that we kind of just associate with America and see as these kind of this land of opportunity and all this stuff, whereas American Honey kind of leaves you in this space in between to kind of figure out what happens to the people who are kind of left behind and don't have people to depend on, and so you feel like they have this freedom and this kind of independence to do whatever they want. But equally, it's very kind of scary to not have, like, at the beginning when Crystal sort of asked her, like, do you have anyone who's going to miss you when you're gone? And she says no. And obviously, on the one hand, that grants you a lot of freedom to literally just kind of pack up and do whatever you want. But then the idea that they are kind of literally just kind of flying free, in the sense that, yeah, no one will miss them, and it really doesn't matter what happens to them. And I think that is a very kind of, what's the word, like, terrifying sense of freedom. Like, it's not a freedom that you necessarily want to have. So you kind of at once want to be with the characters and enjoy what they're doing, but you also don't want to be them at all, which I think is a very interesting place to be as a spectator.
Absolutely. What about for yourself, Dallas? When did you sort of first see this, and what was your reaction to it?
I mean, I caught this one, I think, on first release at the cinema. I think it was maybe Andrea Arnold that was drawing me to it more than the subject matter. I was worried that I might not really connect with it. I think seeing on the trailers about these sort of young people sort of having a laugh going across America, I was like, oh, I'm not sure if I'm going to like these. But, you know, I'd loved sort of, well, Red Road and sort of Fish Tank, I thought were superb. I loved their adaptation of Wuthering Heights. You know, they're all sort of, you know, Fish Tank and Red Road are both sort of difficult films to watch and have really tough subject matters. So I was interested to see, you know, they were all very, very British stories. So I was interested to see what she was going to bring to this American tale. And I thought it was a real sense of immediacy, and the fact that Robbie Ryan, who, you know, she'd worked with on all her previous films, the cinematography of basically you're almost like part of this gang, you're in there in the truck and on the bus and stuff while they're driving across America, it really sort of draws you in. And I really sort of liked that. I thought you could tell that a lot of these people were sort of non-actors, you know, and they were just sort of there, and there was a lot of improvisation, but I thought that really sort of added to it. And any sort of doubts I had initially about the film, I think, sort of melted away during the Rihanna We Found Love sequence, which was just one of the high points, I think, of the year, and one of the best uses of music that year. And I loved the film and that song so much that I needed to have that song played at my wedding. I thought I just fell in love with that song at that point in time.
Did you get up on a checkout and dance at your wedding?
Well, we didn't get married in a supermarket, so unfortunately we couldn't do that. But if there was one at the hotel I was at, then I would have done it.
Like, I was the same. I saw it opening weekend. I don't even really remember seeing much in the way of trailers or thinking, oh, I really need to go see that film. But it was sort of like, oh, I really like Andrea Arnold's films, I'll give this a go. And then I think I remembered being immediately sort of being surprised by the aspect ratio of the film, and that was a bit of a surprise. And I thought for a second, oh, is this meant to be that way? And obviously it was. And I was the same. I wasn't sure what to expect, but within that kind of first few minutes when sort of that Rihanna song kicks in, I was like, I'm immediately on board for this. I just was really hooked in. And I think apart from knowing Shia LaBeouf, like, I just thought this was such a really interesting cast. And Sasha Lane was one of those kind of talents in this film. I was like immediately just kind of gripped by just watching her kind of go through this story. And it was a real surprise. It was one of my favorite films of the year. And I just thought it was excellent. It's one that, yeah, I think what you said kind of about America, it was so great to see it go through these sort of Kansas and these Midwest cities and towns, oil fields. And I just think it's a great sort of American masterpiece. And I think it's interesting that a British talent has kind of gone over there and made maybe one of sort of the best American road movies maybe of the past decade or potentially ever. I think kind of for Andrea Arnold, she had been sort of, obviously she's been in the press quite a bit this week with sort of the controversy surrounding Big Little Lies, but she obviously wrote this film based on the back of an investigative piece that she'd read in the New York Times about magazine crews. And the article was all about sort of life on the road for the magazine sellers, and talking about the assaults, crime, sexual assault that happened, and all the kind of antics that the people get up to as well. Did you sort of know much about the industry before the film, or had you had a chance to even sort of read this article, Meg?
No, I didn't. I really didn't know much about the film going in, other than I had seen the trailer sort of initially when I thought about watching it. But shamefully, I had not seen, and still actually haven't seen, any other Andrea Arnold films other than this one. So I didn't really have that kind of, foreknowledge of her, the kinds of films that she made, and like her sort of subject matter. But kind of retrospectively, I do think it's really interesting and perhaps almost like necessary that it was made by a British director, because I think that, I mean, there are obviously American directors who are critical of America, but I think sometimes having a bit of an outsider perspective on something can take away a bit of maybe that sort of romanticization of it. I don't know if that's a word, but yeah, so I think it's really interesting that she was the one that made it. And I think that not having read that article, but knowing that it exists and that it is based on, I think it really adds to the sense of like realism and the fact that it was a topic that she obviously read about and then got interested in and then sort of had this vision of something that she needed to create based on this thing that she's read. And then the fact that I think she went to like kind of beaches and stuff, right, and was just like street casting, which is, I'm pretty sure, how she found Sasha Lane, right? Like,
yeah,
she was just on spring break or something. So I really like that aspect of like, not only did she find like a sort of a real story and a real concept that she wanted to make something about, but she wanted to make it sort of with, in like quotes marks, like real people, in the sense that, yeah, any of these like people that she just approached on the street could have been anyone in a similar situation. And I think it adds a lot. And it's something similarly with Moonlight, they did that. I think the kids were just sort of pulled from schools and stuff. And I think very often sort of street casting, especially from the areas that you intend to like film in, from people who are involved in or might be involved in those kinds of situations, does always tend to have really good results. I think in my experience of watching films like that, I think it usually pays off really well, because there is that sense of obviously guaranteed kind of more authenticity. And with a subject like this, and I think it lends itself to like the cinematography is very similar, like all the handheld, it does feel very documentary-esque, like it is very social realist, I guess. So by kind of, other than I guess Shia LaBeouf, like you don't really have much kind of Hollywood like A-list, we recognize these people like type thing going on. So it's nice that they're kind of faces that could be anyone, but then also it was such a kind of star vehicle for Sasha Lane, and it's really amazing to see kind of the things that she's gone on to do since, such as The Miseducation of Cameron Post, which was my favourite film of 2018. So yeah, I'm really kind of excited to see what she does next.
Yeah, like what about for yourself, Dallas? Did you know so much about this sort of magazine industry? Because I know for me that I found it kind of funny, to be honest. I was like, people are selling magazines door to door, and especially when you sort of look at these kind of ragtag bunch of people going door to door, like you're surprised that they even get in kind of the front door, or that the people that they're often targeting seem to be sort of on, you know, low income. You sort of wonder how this kind of operation can succeed. And I was sort of reading in the article that it was based on that magazine subscriptions make up such a low amount of these magazines' incomes, that it's such a small industry, but it's one that's heavily unregulated. And then when a lot of these assaults, you know, conning of perhaps people into buying magazine subscriptions, the police can't catch up with these guys because they're perhaps on to the next state and move on and on again. And there's a really interesting sort of dynamic within these magazine crews with how they operate. If anyone gets the chance, it's definitely well worth reading the New York Times article. You can find it through the Wikipedia entry. But what was it like for you, kind of this insight into sort of the magazine selling culture of America?
Yeah, no, it's something that I wasn't really aware of, and sort of even just the description of it makes it sort of sound like the ideal sort of folly for like a Louis Theroux documentary. So you can imagine him sort of following around, and sort of like Mike said, the film and with the cinematography as it is, it does have a very sort of documentary feel. I mean, if you just turned it on halfway through, you could imagine that it was almost a documentary, because yeah, it does feel very unscripted at times and stuff. And I mean, you do have like, you know, I guess, well, from us, we always have like the romanticized version of the road trip, and this is basically the sort of dark underbelly of it. You know, we've seen films like Road Trip, On the Road, and whatever the great sort of, you know, American stories, and, you know, Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, you know, traveling Route 66 and all this, and this basically shows you what it would really be like to travel sort of door to door, sort of hand to mouth in these things, because, you know, certainly from the British side of it, you know, we're aware of like the Girl Scout cookies and stuff about raising money for stuff like that, where they have to go door to door. And that's a much more wholesome idea. And everyone's like, oh, yeah, no, they're just kids. That's great. We'll buy a dozen boxes and whatever. But this seems to be a much more of a seedy racket that involves a bit more sort of sleight of hand and a bit more of a con job and stuff like that. So it's interesting to watch that side of it. But I mean, I was completely sort of drawn in. I mean, like you said, you know, this film is about 165 minutes long, but it never really felt like that. It does feel like a daunting prospect sitting down to something like that. But I mean, the time just sort of flew by, you know, being with these sort of characters and stuff like that. And I really enjoyed it. And yeah, no, it opened my eyes to seeing it. And I think, like you say, I think it's, yeah, only a British or an outsider sort of filmmaker would have been able to do this effectively, I think, and really sort of shown that sort of the dark side to it, although it does sort of feel in some places very sort of akin to another film we're probably going to talk about in a few episodes' time, The Florida Project, which, you know, there you've got Disneyland, but this is basically showing how the people who sort of work and live around Disneyland are actually affected by everything. So it does have that similar sort of feel to it to that.
You touched on it a little bit, Meg, sort of Andrea Arnold's directing style in this. Did you feel it worked for this kind of film? And obviously something like this, like obviously there's been the controversy about Big Little Lies, that, you know, she has a very unique visual style and how she likes to direct, shoot and edit. And American Honey seems like the perfect kind of representation of her work. Obviously I haven't seen Big Little Lies, so I can't really talk much on that, but what do you think of sort of Andrea Arnold's style in this film, and do you think it lends itself well to this story?
Well, having, like I said, not seen any of her other films, I didn't have a kind of knowledge going in, and I couldn't I suppose use that to inform like how I saw it. But I think in terms of, yeah, like cinematography, kind of editing, like the colour of it, everything, yeah, definitely lends itself to the story in that it is very kind of standard, kind of social realist. Like, it has those conventions of, like, handheld camera, and, yeah, like, a lot of, like, kind of focused on the surroundings as well as the people. Like, it's very much kind of also about, like, the landscape and the environment as well as the people occupying it. And I think you have a lot of... One of the things that I really like about the film is that there's a lot of kind of sort of, like, long takes of like traveling and kind of emphasis on like space and like openness, but then also very occasionally you get these, like, in the middle of a conversation you'll have these really interesting small like intense close-ups on like a random part of someone's body that, like, say Star is looking at, or like maybe a focus on like her hands while she's sort of playing with her hands or something, that kind of emphasizes the ways that the characters are like feeling in that moment without them having to say it. So I feel like it's very much a film of sort of like, I guess, that kind of typical thing of like showing rather than telling. Like, a lot of the time you do notice these things in kind of small details that the camera will like pick up on and show you, but not in a way that it's kind of throwing it right in front of your face. It still feels very like kind of subtle and smooth, and like the shakiness of it, I think, lends to that idea that you feel like you are someone who's just stood there kind of watching it all unfold, and you're just kind of walking around, following them around, joining them in the car, like kind of just observing these moments. And I think also the runtime helps with that in the sense that it doesn't really feel like anything is skipped over or glossed over. Like, they really do take their time to get through everything. It's like, you know, like at least 30 minutes or so before she even kind of really joins the crew and goes off with them, and then like so much like happens and like unfolds in its kind of slowness, which I think, you know, another film with another director maybe would have had a far shorter runtime and would have skipped over the most kind of, not boring, but like the kind of, the moments that maybe a kind of bigger budget, you know, Hollywood style film would see as kind of unnecessary. Like, oh, we just cut that bit, we don't need to see her do that. Whereas this film really makes you sit and watch all of those moments, when it would seem uncomfortable that maybe we should just cut away, we'll just end this scene. But no, she kind of makes you sit there and absorb all of it in all of its discomfort in those moments, which I think is really essential to understanding and empathising with the characters and understanding the situations that they're in. And I think having those elements of like slow cinema makes you really like, is also helps with the immersion, I think, in the sense that, yeah, you don't just kind of have that quick, clean, like, cut that just takes you away from the moment. It kind of moves you on to the next before you've really had a chance to sort of ingest, like, what's going on.
What about for yourself, Dallas? You're different to Meg. You've seen some of Andrea Arnold's other kind of work. Where does this sort of fall for you and sort of her style? And you know, is this sort of film possibly her best film to date?
I think it possibly is, actually, yeah. I mean, it's having sort of seen Red Road and sort of Fish Tank is probably the one it's most sort of comparable to. Red Road is a really sort of dark tale, but it's told from sort of an adult's perspective, whereas Fish Tank comes from a sort of young girl on this sort of London council estate who's sort of finding out who she is and stuff like that. So it's very comparable with that. Essentially, Star is going on this sort of journey of sort of self-discovery. All she knows is she wants to escape her current life, but she doesn't know where she wants to go. And, you know, there is that sort of scene at the end where she's sort of like, you know, she goes into the water and then emerges sort of potentially purified and whatever, which is a theme which I think is sort of explored in the next one we're going to talk about as well. But I really like the fact that for the most part Andrea Arnold seemed to resist the sort of cliches and sort of maybe moments that you'd find in other sort of teen dramas, with the exception of maybe the everyone's sort of pissed off at each other, but a good sing-song on a bus always seems to get everyone back together, whether it's sort of Almost Famous or Pitch Perfect and stuff like that. So beyond that, I thought it was a nice original take on that kind of movie, I thought. And yeah, I think it's probably our best movie to date.
Obviously, kind of Megan mentioned it, sort of how Sasha Lane got to be cast in this film. She was on Spring Break with her friends at the time, and Lane actually thought she was being looked at for a porn film originally, had to be convinced to come back. But obviously, the remainder of the cast were found in parking lots, construction sites, on the streets, state fairs. Obviously, I think this is probably most of our introduction to sort of Sasha Lane. What did you make of her in this sort of leading kind of role for kind of a first-time performer? Dallas?
I thought she was utterly convincing. I wasn't sure for the longest time, I think, if she was, you know, a proper actress or whether she was just someone that they'd found or whatever. I wasn't really sure of her background. The only two people I'd really was aware of was Shia LaBeouf, and this film turned me around on Shia LaBeouf, so all credit to Andrea Arnold on that. And then Riley Keough, I think I'd seen her in a small role. She was one of the women who, in Mad Max Fury Road, I think, who was liberated by Charlize Theron, so was that. But I thought she was fantastic in this, and I was really keen to see what she was going to do next. And like I say, excellent in Miseducation of Cameron Post, and unfortunately took that dip into more mainstream fare in Hellboy, which was not very good and kind of wasted her talents, I thought. But she's definitely a bright talent, and I'm excited to see what she's got lined up in the future.
Yeah, I was the same. This was my first introduction to her, and I fell in love with her in this film. I was desperate to see more, and it felt like this film only felt like, obviously it was a few years ago, but I was like, I need to see her in more things now. And sort of in that past few years, it feels like the films that have sort of maybe been in production a little while, something like Miseducation of Cameron Post, she's great in, Hearts Beat Loud, which I'm a huge fan of that film. I just think she steals the show in that. Obviously Hellboy I've not seen, but it's so great to see kind of casting directors and directors now kept picking her in films, and it's great to see sort of the legacy of American Honey's kind of lived on in that. I just think she's excellent. What about for yourself, Meg? What did you make of Sasha Lane?
Yeah, I think she's amazing. I think it's so essential for a film like this to have, like, and I guess this is probably what Andrew was going for, like to find that kind of person who was going to carry it, and like kind of putting that on an unknown, like possibly non-actor is obviously could be a massive risk, but I think in this case it really paid off, and like she carries the entire film, I think, effortlessly. Like you wouldn't know. Yeah, it's one of those things where I'm like, I want to say like, oh, you wouldn't know that she wasn't an actor, but also like I don't think that's a bad thing if you do, like in the sense that you can almost tell she's not an actor in that like she doesn't necessarily fall into like we're saying those kind of cliches, or like she just almost seems to be being herself. Like, I mean, I don't know what she's like as a person, but also the idea that she just is, like, I don't know how to explain it, but it's sort of like the idea of like when sometimes when people act they feel like they need to like put on something, but sometimes like acting can just be talking how you talk and acting how you act, but just in a certain way. And I feel like she really captures that, if that makes any sense whatsoever. But I think she does have this kind of just innate like charisma and like personality that just makes you want to watch her, even when she's not saying anything or like, I don't know, she just, yeah, she, I was really sold on her mostly for the film. Like, I don't know, yeah, was I a huge Shia LaBeouf fan? I don't even know, I can't really say that I was. I don't know if I really associated him with like this kind of film either, so I was a bit like, oh, this is strange. But yeah, no, she really is quite something. And yeah, I love Hearts Be Loud as well. I have such a soft spot for that film. It made me cry so much. And she is really amazing in it. I think she has such amazing range as well, considering like the kinds of films that she's done since. Like Miss Education Camera poses a lot of comedy as well as kind of drama. And yeah, I think she really has it, whatever that is. I don't know. She's great.
What did you make of Shia LaBeouf in this film? That he plays quite an interesting role, that times he can be charismatic and it can turn on a dime, that he can be quite a threatening and intimidating but submissive character as well. What did you make of him in this turn as the sort of the big name in this, Meg?
Yeah, I think, yeah, he is kind of a difficult one in this. He does it very well, I'll say. Like, the fact that I don't like his character or that he makes me feel like extremely uncomfortable and like all those things that obviously are kind of a credit to Shia's acting, I guess, that, you know, he can kind of encompass, like, he can make you feel so many things in the sense that, yeah, like when you first meet him you understand why she's so kind of like allured by him. Like, he has this kind of look about him and his way about him that does seem quite like appealing, and like you want to know who he is and what he's doing. And he's obviously very good at getting these girls to become interested in him and to kind of sell them on this illusion that they're going to have this great adventure and it's going to be so liberating and they're going to get everything that they want and he's going to fall madly in love with them and they're going to fall madly in love with him too and it's going to be perfect. And I think because you sort of see him through Star's eyes, I suppose, in a lot of ways, like, you understand why she's kind of so taken in by that and that he is so charming in many ways, but then, yeah, also has this side to him that obviously becomes more apparent, like, as we go on, that, you know, I mean, even from the first moment when he, like, goes in to kiss her, like, 5 seconds after meeting her in the parking lot, you're like, yeah, the boundaries here are very kind of uneasy. And obviously she's only 18, like, she's so young and very, obviously very impressionable as well. And it's like, you do get the sense, or at least I got the sense right from the start, that she was kind of being taken advantage of. And then it's interesting and difficult to then watch the love story kind of unfold when you kind of see her being so taken in by it, and it does seem so kind of magical and whirlwind and amazing. But then at the same time, like, by the end when she kind of realizes that, or is led to believe that she's no different from any of these other girls that he's recruited, you feel that heartbreak, I guess, because you've been also taken in by the same illusion, I guess. And I think he carries that off really, really well.
What about for yourself, Dallas? What did you make of his performance in this? Was this one of his finest, or was this sort of second to Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull for you?
Why did you mention that film? Why did you have to bring up that film? That was a film which nearly ruined it for me, for him. I mean, I thought, you know, coming up, I actually enjoyed the first Transformers film. I thought he had a great deal of charisma in that. But yeah, I soured on him after Kingdom of the Crystal Skulls. I soured on everything after that. But for this one, I thought he was, like you say, he was very appearing, alluring, charismatic. He drew you in. And, you know, one of the great things about this film is it's all from Star's perspective. I mean, it's all pretty much following her the entire time. Whereas, you know, another film would probably, you know, show cut to scenes of Shia LaBeouf's character with Riley Keough's character scheming away in a hotel room or something, trying to, you know, give him a bit of a backstory and whatever. But we only really see what he wants to show Star in order to lure. And I mean, she sees this guy who is taking her away from a life where it seems like she's maybe getting sexually abused and stuff like that. So she sees this white knight taken away, and then he then protects her. You know, he's coming after her when she's in the scene where she's at the pool with these three sort of cowboys and sort of doing shots and stuff like that. He is after, trying to protect her and stuff like that. So she sees him as a protector, and then she then feels betrayed when it finds out that, you know, he's maybe done this to everyone. But then there's a hint of possible reconciliation at the end. So I think the he's fantastic in it and plays it sort of fast and loose with the truth, and also his performance, because you're never really sure what he's going to do. And I think it works well, particularly in the style of the film. And I think that, yeah, they make for a great pairing on screen. And yeah, there's real chemistry between the two. And yeah, for me, I think it's one of his finest performances, I think.
The film is sort of made up, as the script is quite loose, but it's made up of so many great moments. What are some of the kind of highlights of the movie for you, Meg?
As well as, I do also want to mention, yeah, the sort of the grocery store scene at the beginning with the Rihanna. That is a great scene. But yeah, I think there are a lot of scenes that stick in my mind, not necessarily because I think they're great, but they're some of the more difficult kind of scenes to watch. But then there's this one moment, like, you know, later in the film, towards the end, where she's just sort of sat and the bear appears, which is one of those really, like, sort of surreal moments that you're like, is this a dream? What's going on? Like, but and it's sort of one of those ones that I'm never quite sure, like, what it means. But it's just a real image that sort of sticks in your mind, I think, when it kind of comes almost, like, pretty much, like, face-to-face with her. And it's, like, this moment of, like, I don't know, like, sort of reflection and stillness after, like, a lot of the kind of, like you say, in the drama kind of unfolds with the men and then him attacking them, and, like, a lot has kind of gone on. And then, yeah, you have this really weird kind of moment that sort of almost happens, like, out of time and out of place, but is really quite, I don't know, like, uncanny, but in a really, really good way. I really like that moment.
What about for yourself, Dallas? I mean, the moment that I've come back to, and I remembered watching it for the first time, and I was absolutely terrified watching it, and it had the same impact on rewatch, was when Star comes in and she finds the lead magazine saleswoman, her name escapes me at the moment, being sort of in the Confederate bikini the price tag on it, and Shia LaBeouf's kind of like oiling her up, and as she's just like dressing down Star, and it's just the most uncomfortable scene on just so many levels. And I just think it's up there with one of the most horrifying, terrifying scenes maybe in A24 films, and kind of in the past decade, while we're at it. What about for yourself? What are some of the standout moments for you?
Well, I was going to mention that one because I knew that you were such a big fan of that one. It's just the way that she's basically giving you, like, telling her exactly what life is actually going to be like this, and how, oh, you think that he likes you and stuff like that, while basically forcing him to basically give her a rub down and put on her suntan lotion and stuff like that, while making Star watch and stuff like that. It's a complete sort of power play, and she knows exactly what she's doing. And yeah, you know, that's one of those, a really sort of memorable scene. And but just, I think it's, yeah, some of maybe the sort of the quieter moments where maybe, like, the use of lighting, where basically they know that you catch these scenes just at sort of dusk or dawn and stuff like that, and the light is so beautiful. They basically have shot it all with natural light, and it's just like, you never really see sort of America like that. It's always, it seems sort of artificial, and it feels like you're seeing the real America for the first time sort of here. So that's, it's, yeah, it's the sort of quieter moments which sort of stick in the mind and stuff like that. Maybe it's just like an image or something like that, when the colours and stuff like that, for me, is what really sort of stuck with me after the film.
Have any of you guys got any kind of final thoughts on sort of American Honey before we move on to Moonlight?
No, I think we've covered all of it, although I just can't think of American Honey. I always seem to have, like, that Lenny Kravitz American Woman song stuck in my head, so I always have to kind of say it in that sort of style. So
where does this sort of film land for you, sort of in your A24 rankings, or sort of top tier, lower tier? Where does this sort of fit for you, Meg?
I can't remember what I actually said. I'd have to go back to our episode of the podcast and remember what I said was my top five, but I'm not sure if it's in my top five or not. I can't remember. I think after, say, the likes of Moonlight, Lady Bird's probably above there. I'd say I probably liked it more. Did I like it more or less than the Florida project? Because it was interesting that you brought that up, because I was thinking about the sort of the similarities between them, and I do really like both, but they're also very different in the sense that the Florida project being through the eyes of like children is that makes that very different. But I think I put A Ghost Story above as well. I think my top three may have been Moonlight, Lady Bird. Oh, and 20th Century Women is also really up there for me. But yeah, I would definitely say American Honey is like top tier, definitely top end. Yeah, it's a really good one for me, a really memorable one for me. But also, I'm also not a huge rewatcher of films, especially if I find them either very like long or quite difficult watching experiences. So it's maybe not a film that I would revisit, you know, time and time again, because it's the kind of film that I think I would need to like leave for a certain amount of time and then revisit. Whereas like Moonlight, I've seen quite a lot of times now, which I don't know. But again, even with Moonlight, actually, I think it kind of needs its time because it's such a like a intense experience, I suppose. But yeah, I could definitely see myself watching it again, like a while from now, and kind of reflecting on what it means and how I kind of perceive it and that sort of thing.
What about for yourself, Dallas? Where does this rank for you so far?
For me, so far, I'm building my sort of A24 ranking list from the ground up as we go through the project. So this one is definitely in the top 10 for me at the moment, just outside the top 5, but where it will end up at the end, I don't know. I think there's quite a few coming up that might sort of bump it out of the top 10 in the end, but at the moment it's definitely top tier at the moment.
I'm the same as you. I have in my head, I've seen about 77, I think, of their films so far, but I'm kind of going through my rankings as we kind of chip off these movies. So as it stands, will it be still in the same place at the end of this episode? I would have this as my second favorite after Under the Skin to date. So yeah, it'll be interesting to see if it's still number two in 20 odd minutes. So I think that brings us to Moonlight, and we sort of come to this one at last. It's our theme song for the podcast. So A24's first Oscar winner for Best Picture, written and directed by Barry Jenkins, and based on the unpublished semi-autobiographical play In Moonlight, Black Boys Look Blue. So Moonlight chronicles the life of a young black gay man from childhood to adulthood as he struggles to find his place in the world while growing up in a rough neighbourhood of Miami. So Meg, what was your introduction to Moonlight, and what was your reaction? Like, as you've mentioned, you're a passionate fan of this film. Was it something that got into you straight away?
Oh yeah, me and Moonlight have had a journey. Where did we meet? So I first saw Moonlight at a preview. Oh, so it was, it premiered in the UK, I believe, at LFF in 2016, which I didn't get to see. That was my first LFF actually, and I wasn't there on like a press pass or anything. I was just, I don't know, an average member of the public, I suppose. So I didn't see it, but I was kind of vaguely aware of its existence, and I remember it having its premiere and stuff and it kind of catching my eye. And then obviously kind of attention around it grew towards the end of the year. And then in, I'm going to say either late January or early February, the BFI did a preview screening of it, because I don't think it came out in the UK till something like March or April. So like in the January there was this preview screening, and I go to a lot, like I live fairly close to the BFI, so I'm fortunate enough to be able to take advantage of a lot of those screenings, and they're also £3 for like under 25, so it's sort of like a how could I not kind of situation. So I went to see it, and it's funny, I don't really remember entirely what my expectations of it were. I think I just had heard a lot of kind of critical acclaim surrounding it following like LFF and things, and kind of also in the lead up to the Oscars that year. So I went to see that preview screening, and I went to it. Yeah, I just went with my flatmate, and I remember being a bit disappointed because we got, because it was a preview screening, it was sold out. So we queued up for standby tickets, and we got like some of the last ones. and the only seats left were the very front row, which was a bit of a nightmare because I was sort of sat with my head like cranked, like it was not that comfortable. But in a way, I don't know if it added to the experience in the end, because I was so close to the screen, like physically, that I was just completely, like that first like opening shot of like Juan driving his car sort of into towards the camera, I was like, okay, this is right in my face. And like I sort of from the get-go was kind of headfirst immersed into it. And yeah, it was just, I don't remember a film, even, I would say even Carol, like Carol, I think the love that I have Carol is very different from the love that I have for Moonlight. So I'm not sure that I remember a film in the same way that after I saw it, I was like completely speechless. Like it was almost like the time had completely flown. Like I felt like everything had happened and nothing had happened at the same time. I sat there in my seat after it ended, the credits were rolling. I was just sat there. I couldn't speak. I could not move. My flatmate was like, do you want to leave? And I was like, you're going to have to give me a minute because I'm processing. And yeah, I was completely overwhelmed. I was sort of like, I don't know what I've seen, but also I feel like I understand everything. Like, I don't know what it was. It was just, it was a story that I just felt completely immersed in. And it's interesting considering that it's a story that I have very little familiarity with, in the sense that I am very unlike the protagonist as a young black man living in America, other than being gay. That's like literally the only similarity going on here. So it's, I think it's a testament to the film that I was just, I don't know, I was just completely enraptured and felt so many things watching it. And then I was then devastated that because it was a preview screening and it wasn't coming out for like another 2 months or something, that I couldn't see it again. I was like, I need to see this again, like right now. Which, like I said before, I don't really rewatch films. I don't know why, but I don't. Whereas this, like immediately after seeing it, I was like, we need to watch this again and we need to understand what just happened. So then fortunately there was another screening of it at the BFI like a month later or something, that was a Q&A with Barry Jenkins and Terrell McCraney, which I then also queued up for and got into, and so watched it again. Again, it was like, even on a second viewing, it was like, it just flew by, like the film just happened and I was there and I witnessed it. And then again, and then having the Q&A afterwards was so enlightening. And like, I think listening to them talk about it and their influences and the sort of story behind it just opened it up so much more to me. And then I went and saw it for a third time at the cinema, and then I've seen it, I don't know how many, a few times since then. I then wrote my dissertation about it partially. Like, it's a film that I don't think I could ever tire of revisiting, which is not something that I say that often, because I don't know, I just don't often get that much out of one single film. And also I was a bit like, I'm afraid to write my dissertation about this film because what if I end up hating it? But the fact that I still don't, after like analysing all of these scenes and writing like X many thousands of words about it, I'm still very much in love with this film, and it just touched me in a way that, I don't know, I can't explain it. I feel like this hasn't been articulate at all, other than me just being like, this film exists and it's amazing and I'm in love with it. And it, I don't know, I think it, I don't know, it just seemed to me to be everything that a film should be. Like, it didn't put a foot wrong. Like, I don't really say that many films are perfect, but I honestly wouldn't change a single frame of Moonlight. Like, I don't think a single thing about it could be improved in any single way. Like, it just is. I feel like I need to stop there.
No, that's pitch perfect. For about yourself, Dallas, how did you sort of see this film for the first time, and what was it, what was the experience like for you?
I think I saw opening day when it came out, because it was just, it came out like the week before the Oscars in the UK, so I was wanting to do my, you know, make my informed decision, make everything, so I've watched all the main films which have been nominated so I can make an informed decision about what I think is going to win. At that point, I don't think I truly appreciated how great this film is, because I was very much team La La Land at that point. I was, as a white man who saved jazz, obviously, you know, that film spoke to me, and you know, I'd probably seen it a couple of times by that. I just loved that film. But and then Moonlight one, I was like, oh, right. I was as shocked as everyone. And then there was the whole thing about, oh, how did it win? And then I had this whole thing about, well, it must have been because of the sort of the ballot system being a preferential vote. You know, some people hated La La Land, so put it at number 8, whereas everyone probably put Moonlight in the sort of top 2 or 3, so therefore it won. And I wasn't mad about it. I was like, you know, La La Land deserved to win, but Moonlight also deserved to win. And I only actually got around to rewatching it just for a couple of days ago. And yeah, this film is a absolute masterpiece. As good, if not better. I mean, If Beale Street Could Talk is the best film which I've seen this year. Avengers Endgame is probably my favourite. You know, the whole sort of Captain America portal sequence will go down as one of my favourite sequences of cinema in all time. But If Beale Street for me was just an absolutely perfect film. The cinematography, the score, everything was great. And sort of watching back, you could see all that in Moonlight, and I just thought it was absolutely sensational. You know, Hitchcock once said, if it's a good movie, you could turn the sound off and the audience would still have a perfectly clear idea of what's going on. I think Barry Jenkins is a superb filmmaker at doing that. You can tell so much of what's going on in Moonlight with his use of close-ups, with his the emotion that the characters can convey with just their eyes. I think the entire story is being told without words as well, and I think that's just superb filmmaking, and I think he's one of the best filmmakers working at the moment. And yeah, that's where I am at.
Yeah, for me, I caught it at a preview Cineworld screening, and I had a wee scroll back into sort of my Twitter feed, and when this trailer first kind of dropped, it must have been sort of a wee while before the London Film Festival came around, like the trailer dropped, and I was like, I was blown away by this trailer. I thought the score, the imagery, the close-ups, the cinematography, it was like, wow, this film looks unbelievable. And I remembered sort of sharing it with a couple of my my close friends who are gay, and I was like, guys, check out this film. Like, you know, we've had conversations before. They don't necessarily follow sort of indie cinema, so, you know, kind of being exposed or hearing about these films can often come when they win the awards or kind of later down the line. And I was like, guys, check out this film. And they were sort of like, oh yeah, we'll have to check that out. And I was sort of just immediately hooked in after that trailer. And I remembered sort of the buzz from London and sort of as it was kind of going through the circuit. And then when I got to see this preview, thinking it was like a late Monday night kind of showing, and I was really hyped going in, and I was worried it was maybe going to disappoint. And it didn't. I thought it was definitely one of the best films of that year. And when it came to the Oscar, I was hoping it was going to win, but I'd sort of made peace that I thought La La Land was probably the more likely one to win based on these things. But I was really pleased and surprised to see it win. But I think what the film does well, and I think films like Her Smell and Steve Jobs have sort of done it in the past few years really well, is that it tells the film in sort of three parts as opposed to sort of a biopic and story running over several decades where, you know, each kind of era is given short shift and it moves on and it moves on. And I thought that was a really effective kind of storytelling mechanism. Was that an effective way for telling this love story for you, Meg?
Yeah, definitely. I remember... I think Cameron feels like the second or third time I watched it. I remember kind of trying to figure out if they were exactly the same amount of time. I don't know why. I remember checking my watch whilst watching the film to figure out if they were like equal sort of acts, if that makes sense. And they are. They're almost exactly like, I think, about sort of 40 minutes each, which I think is really interesting because sometimes like you would sort of have a shorter chapter of them being a child and then most of it is about them being an adult, where it's sort of like completely equal time is given to these three stages in his life, and therefore it's like not one of the actors or not one of the versions of Sharon is kind of the lead or is kind of more important than the other. It's like each of these stages in his life is equally kind of fundamental to his growth in some way. I think personally the first act is my favourite and probably always will, but I don't know, Alex Hibbert is just amazing as young Sharon, and like the scenes of him and Juan, I guess, because obviously we don't get Juan later on in the film, which is so sad, but I mean the fact that Mahershala Ali is only in like the first 40 minutes of the film and steals it and won an Oscar, like I love the start of the film and the end and the middle. I mean, we've established that I love all of it. But yeah, I think it has a really nice sense of sort of like continuity and kind of a cyclicalness to it, which was something that I wrote about when I studied the film, in the sense that a lot of like Sharon's sort of relationships are either revolve around or kind of involved in some way, like food and being kind of nurtured and taken care of by other people. And at the beginning, that is with Juan, who kind of finds him and like buys him a meal at the diner and kind of introduces him to like the idea of like receiving love and kind of sustenance from someone, and also a father figure that he lacks. And then later on, that's also Teresa, and then only Teresa after we don't see Juan anymore. And like often you have these scenes around dinner tables or that involve kind of food. And then later, obviously in the third act, when he meets Kevin again, almost all of that takes place in a diner, and that is when he kind of cooks in the chef special. And again, it's like you sort of see how like by receiving food from someone else, in this case another man, he kind of understands how to accept love and kind of intimacy. And it's just incredible. The final diner scene is unreal. Like it's just so good. The atmosphere of it is just so, like, I don't know, it's kind of like the whole film culminates in this moment of like, where has he come to at this point, and like how has he changed? But then also like the moment that he sees Kevin again, you just see this like little boy from the beginning, and like this vulnerability, and it's sort of like everything that's happened to him almost doesn't matter. It just kind of comes back down to like this connection that these two men have, and it's unreal. And yeah, so I think the fact of like having him grow physically on screen shows you the development of his character, like visually obviously, but then also yeah, it allows you to make those connections between his sort of his past and his present, and how all of those sort of really fundamental things that happen in his life impact him in the present. Like it would be completely different if you only saw him as a child or as an adult. Like I don't think it would have that sense of like sort of cause and effect in the things that happen to him.
What about for yourself, Dallas? What do you make of this three-act structure of this film?
I thought it was a fantastic way of getting to really sort of know and understand the character by sort of these are sort of three pivotal moments in his journey and his growth. And it's about sort of finding someone that you can sort of be yourself around, or finding acceptance. And in the beginning, it's Juan who... Yeah, Mahershala Ali is fantastic in this film, and he sort of, there's that tragic moment where it's like he finds out that Naomi Harris is doing sort of crystal meth, and it's like he's got that quandary of that, well, she's like, she's basically daring him to stop selling crystal meth to her, and she's like, you know, are you going to raise my son and stuff like that? And you can see the pain in his face that he's like, he's responsible for, in part for Chiron's situation, so that's why he wants to help him. And then yeah, he is a huge sort of loss in the sort of going forward, but he is sort of replaced. I think the actress who plays sort of Kevin sort of going forward, you've got Jarelle Jerome, who's is the sort of teenage Kevin. He was fantastic recently in When They See Us on Netflix. And then Andre Holland in the third chapter, who's High Flying Bird, is one of the best films on Netflix at the moment, and I've seen this show. He's fantastic, so it's great to see that. And I think they found the actors who play Chiron throughout the different stages, you know, as little Chiron and then Black, are all exceptional. Trevante Rhodes is fantastic at the end, with doing so much with so little, and you can really see how these situations have affected him. And then it all sort of comes, sort of washes away at the end. You know, there's water plays a huge part in this. You know, he's taught to swim in the beginning. He's often, you know, his first sexual encounter takes place at the beach by water, and he's often seen sort of dipping his head into water, submerging himself, and then sort of coming out sort of clean at the end. And I think it's just, it's beautifully told, and I think it's the perfect structure to tell this person's story, I think.
We talked on there, Mahershala Ali and Naomi Harris as well are great in the supporting roles. And what blows my mind is Naomi Harris shot, you know, 3 decades worth of her character in 3 days on this film. What did you guys make of her performance in this film, Meg?
Oh yeah, she's unreal. Like, yeah, I remember, I think it was in the Q&A that Barry first mentioned the fact that she was on set for like 3 days, which is insane, because I feel like watching this film, you feel like you've gone through this like epic journey that obviously takes place over so many years that it seems impossible that somebody could like emulate that much character development and like physical aging and also emotional mental aging in just 3 days, which is like obviously a huge testament to just her skill as an actor. But yeah, that she is amazing. And I think, yeah, she's a really interesting character because obviously, you know, her like neglect of Sharon is a huge part of like his sort of trauma and what leads him to kind of need to be taken in by Juan and Teresa. But at the same time, she's still a character that you empathise with and sympathise with, and you understand the struggles that she's going through, and obviously her struggle with like addiction, and like you said, something that Juan even then has a role in. So it's interesting how kind of these characters aren't all kind of completely it strings it to these problems. And yeah, like she has some really kind of incredible moments, like that shot where it's sort of that slow motion, like there's no audio, but it's just her sort of like shouting at him, but just sort of down the barrel, like at us almost. That is one of the really overwhelming kind of powerful moments where she's just screaming and you feel like that little kid that he is, who's being shouted at. And yeah, she has such a powerful presence. Yeah, considering she's not in a whole lot of it, and like, yeah, she is really, really amazing. She blew me away.
What did you make of it? Dallas, this is sort of quite a unique role for her in her filmography. What did you think of her performance?
I mean, when you watch it, I had no idea that she'd shot it in 3 days, which is, you know, incredible in itself. But to think that she's actually then having to have this emotional relationship with the character, but she's also playing opposite each incarnation of Chiron. So she's got to play, you know, against little Chiron and Black across, you know, this gentleman's entire life. And she's able to do that with each act and build that. You can tell that she's got that relationship with each one, and she does that seamlessly and in such little time. It's such a powerful performance, and you can see why she was nominated for the Oscar, because she, when she's not on screen, she's still, you can still feel the impact that she's had on the character going down the line.
One of my favourite characters in this film, I suppose it's a cliche to say it, is the score by Nicholas Bretel. He uses a chop and screw technique to create this really unique sound, and the soundtrack is obviously our intro to this podcast. What do you think of the soundtrack, Meg? I know for me, when I first heard it played in the trailer, I was really hooked in. And, you know, before I did this podcast today, I just sat and watched the trailer again with my girlfriend, and she went, "I don't know why, but listening to this music is making me scared and a bit terrified." What do you make of the score? Does it terrify you, scare you, or does it make you think, wow, this is a true love theme for the ages?
Yeah, I think terrifying is a really interesting word to use for it, and I think it does sum up in some ways, yeah, my feelings towards it. I remember hearing it in the trailer, and like that really specific track, The Middle of the World, which plays when he's being taught to swim. Which is that really sort of jarring, sort of quite staccato like violin that's going on, that's very high-pitched and, yeah, very like, uncanny, very uncomfortable. But also, maybe uncanny is a good word, because like, I feel like it's very haunting in a way that you don't want to stop listening to it. Like, I feel like it's scary and uncomfortable, but like in that way that you can't not look away or, you know, close your ears, I suppose, in this case. But yeah, so I think that was definitely a big part of what made me kind of so almost like hypnotized by the film, because this music is so unusual and like, yeah, it's not necessarily romantic, but it is at the same time, and it's not scary, but it's not like beautiful. Like, it's sort of all of those things like together, and especially like in those moments where he's being taught to swim, or like, I think the kind of uncanniness of it and even the scariness of it kind of really sums up a lot of what he must have been feeling. And I suppose it sort of lends itself to that kind of mindset of like kind of having this like frantic mind full of like thoughts and emotions and confusion, and especially in this, the scene where he's being taught to swim, where he is literally in the middle of the world, as it's called. Like, the sea is sort of this, like, transitional space, like, this almost, like, limbo that he's kind of in as he's sort of just floating on the surface of the water. And I think that is such a simple moment, but it feels so monumental, and you're not even sort of sure why at the moment that it's happening. But yeah, no, the music, yeah, I think absolutely you could say it's a character. I think it without it, the film would be entirely different and maybe wouldn't even have the same emotional impact that I think that it does.
What do you make of the score, Dallas?
I mean, the score is absolutely fantastic. I mean, Nicholas Britell is a genius, I think, and If Beale Street Could Talk is my favourite score of the year so far. But this one, I think why it works is it's not what you expect to see. You know, with a film like this, you'd expect, you know, a lot of maybe hip-hop music and maybe a sort of rougher, edgier score. But this is... Initially, it doesn't feel like it'd be the right choice, but in the end, it's perfect. And I guess that's what maybe... It's sort of maybe how Chiron's feeling. He's feeling very out of place and like he doesn't fit in. But when he finds that one person that truly understands him, then everything falls into place. And I think that's why the music works so well. It all sort of fits in and leads up to this moment at the end where everything sort of finally clicks and falls into place for them. And I think that's why it works so well. And it's the perfect choice for the story that they're telling.
Meg, the one thing I'd love to know about with this film is that, you know, me and Dallas can debate and discuss it, but, you know, the one thing that was really important with this film is that this was the first Oscar-winning film for, you know, an LGBT story but told through black characters. What's this film's importance and sort of been reaction within the LGBTQI plus community?
I think, yeah, it's a really interesting question. And yeah, I was 100% behind Moonlight in the Oscar race. I love La La Land, admittedly. I love both films. Like, I know a lot of people were sort of either or about it, but I actually genuinely love both films, and I would have been happy for La La Land to have won. But in this case, like, it was without a doubt for me the better and more deserving film. But yeah, also it had that additional... like, this feels like a huge milestone. And yeah, not only is it a film about gay people, it's a film about a black gay man. And it's, yeah, that does feel pretty huge. And like, yeah, even though our lives are very different, and obviously it's like not every LGBT film kind of, I suppose, represents me specifically as a person, but in terms of the community as a whole, like, yeah, it absolutely does. And it's, yeah, I think that is something really profound. And the fact that the play that it was based on is like semi-autobiographical, and you have like written by a gay man, and obviously Barry Jenkins is not, but like he I always say he's a director, like he's allowed, like, you know what I mean? He's a director that I wholeheartedly trust to kind of tell those kinds of stories, because obviously there's a lot of debate of like, you know, like, should we be having kind of more LGBT representation sort of behind the screen and like in the actors as well. And I think this is a case where the film was clearly made with so much kind of respect and like integrity, like in terms of the subject matter, that the people that were involved cared so deeply about the story that they were telling, and did it in a way that was kind of just, it just blew me away that it felt like such a kind of wholehearted and deep representation of what it feels like to grow up gay and to not necessarily have the means to understand that, or the kind of the authority figures to guide you or tell you what those things mean. Like, for me, one of the kind of the most heartbreaking scenes is the one where like little Chiron is sat around the table with Juan and Teresa, and he says that he's been called like a slur at school, and they have to explain to him what that means. And it is such like a common experience for young LGBT people to first hear those words in a negative context, and that can have such like a damaging effect on your kind of view of yourself and your understanding of what those words mean. But the way that the scene was handled, and in particular, like, the way that Juan and, like, obviously Mahershala's performance, like, handles that as he explains it. And I love that line where he kind of says, like, because, you know, in another conversation, he could have said, like, oh, like, don't let anyone call you that. Like, no one could call you gay. Like, that's, you know, don't let that happen. But he's saying, like, well, you know, you might actually be. Like, that's a thing, but don't let anybody talk down to you about it. You know, he's saying, like, if you are, then that's fine, but don't let people bully you for it, you know. But he's still very much affirming the fact that it's okay to be that way. And I don't know, that just felt so profound to me in that moment watching it, that I was like, yeah, imagine having someone tell you that at that age. Like, that could change so much about your sort of outlook on what it means to be gay. And I think that, yeah, so much about the story has those really, like, and then, and I think it's also summed up kind of by the end where, you know, after all he's been through, after everything that's happened in the film, it culminates in this really, like, intimate, tender moment between these two men where he feels able to be the most vulnerable. I mean, we can assume from, like, because he asks him, you know, have you ever been with another man, like, you know, since us when we were, like, teens, and he's like, no, and he's like, you're the only man that sort of ever, like, touched me in that way. And it just shows that, I don't know, it's like the amount that he's been through, and as, like, as strong as he is as a person, he still feels unable to express that part of him and to be so kind of physically vulnerable in front of another person, that the moment that, I think the fact that the film doesn't end with this big kind of sweeping romantic, like, kiss or something, but it's just sort of this, like, embrace between them that he finally feels, like, for the first time probably since having, like, Juan and Teresa, like, someone who is sort of going to take care of him and, like, look after him. And you don't even necessarily know if they are going to kind of rekindle a relationship or anything like that, but just simply having sort of someone who understands him and has been through partially this experience with him is just such, like, a moment of, like, self-recognition and, like, comfort that, I don't know, I don't know, the film really just says a lot to me and kind of, yeah, it is just, I don't know, it's perfect. I don't really know what else I can say, but yeah.
I think that's almost the perfect moment to wrap this on. It's perfect. It's the film of the decade. Dallas, have you got any kind of final thoughts on Moonlight?
No, it's a perfect film. And for me, at the moment, looking at my list, it's at my number two. It's only just behind Under the Skin. But that's because Moonlight wasn't set in Scotland with scenes in a transit van that I can relate to. So therefore, but otherwise, yeah, perfect.
Yeah, it's the same for me, just behind Under the Skin at the moment. But, you know, it's been so great to chat with you on this episode, Megan. I hope we can get you back on here again. If people wanted to listen to you talk about any more kind of subjects, movies, where can kind of people read your writing, listen to your podcast? Where can people kind of find all those things?
Oh, yes. Yeah. So I am assistant editor, writer, podcast at Screen Queens. And the podcast has the same name, it's Screen Queens Podcast. We're at Screen Queens on Twitter, SQ Podcast on Twitter. Yeah, I write about all sorts of things. I mean, we have mostly a focus on women-made and LGBT filmmaker-made work, which is, as we've probably established, is my area of interest and expertise. So yeah, so I talked about Moonlight at length on our podcast episode of IA24. But yeah, you can, if you wish, if you enjoyed my many ramblings about gay things, then you could find more of them at Screen Queens and recently Berlin Film Journal. But other than that, yeah, I'm pretty at home at Screen Queens. That's where I spend the most of my time.
What about for yourself, Dallas? If people wanted to hear a white male's opinion on these sorts of films, where could people find them?
Oh, they can find me on Twitter at @champcelluloid, and I've just realised that when I said it was just behind Under the Skin, I should have said, but it's still a film that got under my skin, because that's a much cooler way to say it. Ooh, so yeah, that's, I'm just revising my earlier statement. Yeah. What about yourself? Where can they find you on Twitter?
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter at Lee_Nostromo. And I just want to thank people that have left some really nice reviews for us kind of recently on the podcast. It's been great. And those that got us into sort of the top 150 on the iTunes charts and stuff in America, that was really awesome. So it's been good to know that people are enjoying the show or maybe enjoying the films. And we're sort of a nice little kind of companion piece to that. It's been really good. So thanks to everyone for listening. And most of all, thanks for Meg for coming on. You know, definitely check out her podcast and her writing. It's always definitely on the top of my list. So yeah, I think you've got a Cats episode out this week that I still have to listen to. So
yes,
I will be checking that one out straight away.
Yeah, no, thank you so much for having me. It's been lovely talking about this with you guys.
Absolutely. This is almost double the length of our usual movie episode.
I know, I was like, we're really getting on for time here.
If we didn't have to do another one in 3 minutes time, I'm sure we could have gone on for double the length of time. But hopefully you'll join us again in the future. And thanks again for coming on. And thanks you guys for listening. So we'll see you next in 2 weeks time with Oasis Supersonic. And then we'll have Munster as well. So thanks for listening. Bye.